Regardless of where you stand on the matter of data science sexiness, it's simply impossible to ignore the continuing importance of data, as well as our ability to analyze, organize, and contextualize them. Data are changing how our businesses and societies function. They are being used to solve a ton of interesting problems and shaping the questions we can ask of the world around us. Hi, I'm James Lee, and this is DataCast. Join me for raw conversations with practitioners from the worlds of AI, machine learning, statistics, and data science.
Hi listeners, this is DataCast. We have a long-form in-depth conversation with data practitioners to unpack the narrative shown into the career. My guest today is Vinod Chanda, the creator and project member committee chair of the Apache Hudi project, a seasoned distributed system database engineer and a dedicated entrepreneur. During his time at Uber, he created Hudi, which pioneered transactional data lakes, as we know them today, as a way to serve unique needs of speed and scale for Uber's massive data platform. He has deep experience with database, distributed system, and data system panel-scale, strengthened through his work at Oracle, LinkedIn, Uber, and Confluent. Most recently, Vinod founded OneHouse, a cloud-native managed lakehouse to make data lakes easier, faster, and cheaper. So Vinod, it is my pleasure to have you on the show.
Great to be here, and I'm a big fan of your podcast, so it's so awesome to be part of one. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I want to start our conversation a little bit all the way back with your educational background. So I found out that you study IT from Madras Institute of Technology back in Chennai, India, where you did some work on security models for multicast security in cloud computing environments. So could you mind briefly going over your upbringing as well as your college experience back in India?
Yeah, well, this goes like way back, and I deeply appreciate the amount of research you put into your shows, and it clearly shows here. Yeah, my undergrad, it's not a lot of interesting things, just a usual, typical Indian student entering technical engineering school. It was a very good school, lucky to be part of the Madras Institute of Technology engineering program there. It's called IT, even though it's basically computer science. And this is one of the biggest things I had to explain. And nobody stopped about my undergrad for a while, so I'm explaining it after a very long time. So IT means something really different in India. Like IT is basically computer science because of all the IT outsourcing companies, the service companies that you see there. So it's practically computer science. This is where I got my first exposure to distributed systems. And back then, this is before Hadoop, right? And if you remember those days, we called it grid computing. And essentially, there were so many awesome projects that were around OpenMOSIX. There was a project at Wisconsin or Purdue, I forgot, called Condor, I think. There are all these like scientific parallel computing, MPP sort of like things. I got exposed to a lot of them in my, like my senior year there. And I actually started at it from a security angle on, hey, how do you run group video applications or essentially multicast applications on it? But by the end of that year, I was smitten by, oh, this is fun, working with distributed systems, computers, talking to each other. We built the university's first real-time application clusters. We used OpenMOSIX and remeshed a whole bunch of machines that the people are happy about for us doing all of those things. Really fun exposures to this. And also, I think another very interesting project that I got the good fortune of working on was with the Indian Space Research Organization. The university designed a student satellite along with that. And I actually got to write the telemetry controller for that. So basically, it was so cool that I wrote this piece of code that would run in our sort of like satellite uplink station. Every day for a few hours, the satellite would be in contact. And then we would like download telemetry data every day and got to build up some. Again, like all of these things made me appreciate network and how hard is that for two computers to connect over very unreliable networks and whatnot and do something meaningful. That's what I took away from my education, I would say, there.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that context. How do you get deeper into the domain of distributed system? I'm just curious, when you say you found that this specialization very fun and very interesting, like, what about it that you found very appealing to focus on? Is there other computer science areas?
Got it. Yeah, it's a little bit of a weird thing, but I learned to appreciate that 3 years happened and somehow getting these many computers cooperating with each other in the face of failures was really fascinating to me. Because, yeah, you can clearly achieve, you can scale out distributed processing. You can do a lot of amazing computing problems can be solved this way, but the infrastructure to make those things happen, a lot of them had to be abstracted here now. A lot of hard problems need to be solved. And there is a lot of logical thinking involved in it. I'm not actually super good. If I have to rate myself, I'm not on the analytical side. Maybe I'm not really great at numbers, but for me also personal level, I think I'm much, much better on the logical thinking, the critical thinking side of things. So for me, it was like a natural draw for me as well. Things like, as we'll probably chat about later, like Paxos, like consensus algorithms, all of those things were like very interesting to me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for talking about the inclination towards logical thinking and appreciation for failure as well. So after you finished your college degree, you moved to the US and you pursue a master's degree in computer science from University of Texas in Austin. And I believe that you also did some research on high bandwidth content distribution and large scale parallel processing with shell pipes. Yeah. How would you describe your overall graduate school experience in Austin? And furthermore, how did you become interested in some of this research area?
Yeah. It's a great question. So Austin, obviously a great school in a great city, stellar computer science program. And if you notice, I got to actually, again, I consider myself pretty lucky that I got to work on two pretty completely different areas, right? One was the vehicular content distribution project, where I stumbled on that from a course project actually that I did, and then that the professor really liked it, and I spent the summer in on campus. So I took that up on, I became an RA, started working on that as my thesis. The second one was actually, that was a work that I did with a researcher in Texas Advanced Computing Center. It was really fascinating. Again, with that same undergrad background, we had, 200 computers linked to a network, and we felt super awesome that we'd done something super amazing. Then I walk into TAC and there is a 8,000 core supercomputer that does crunches all the weather reports for, I think, all of the southern states, right? So yeah, and then these researchers running massive MPP programs, parallel computers. So the fun story there was I landed in UT and I really wanted to work on TAC, and it didn't happen in my first semester there. And I ended up being like persistent, and through the summer I landed this and also a very cool mobile networking project. And I didn't want to choose. So I kept going at it. We ended up producing papers on both. And the thing that they say that you cannot connect the dots in forward and only backwards. The funniest thing was 10 years after that, at Uber, I found myself in the same exact position where I was working on very big data processing on one hand, and also leading Uber's mobile networking team that was actually working on pretty much the exact same problem, right? That fast moving cars, how can they have reliable network connectivity? That was the core of my thesis at UT, and I ended up actually leading 10 years later the same two problem areas at Uber in a very similar context, which is again like vehicular content distribution. But yeah, I stumbled. One was my passion, one was my choice. And at the end of UT, I had choices to make. I could go deeper into embedded systems. That was, again, just to paint a picture, this was when there was no iPhone, right? I was writing on Windows Mobile, Windows CE, like all the older platforms for mobile. And so the whole mobile space to me was like really interesting. I wanted to see if I want to get on the Android team or the iOS team and be part of the next mainstream OSs, right? That's one. On the other hand, we did all this work in IoT on around parallel processing, distributed systems. And again, like it kept fascinating me. Mm-hmm. And when I had to choose my job out of UT, I had the fortune of having these choices, and I ended up going to Oracle and work on databases, distributed databases specifically. And I think, from there, I think I'd never look back. It's become my career, basically.
Yeah. Actually, thanks for sharing the story in the context of this curiosity that you pursue in grad school. It's how you just follow some of these interesting areas. You never know how the passion going to become beneficial later down your career in the sense that we talk about some of that and work over later on in conversation. But kind of, stepping back into that transition when you accepting that job right out of school at Oracle, you spent about 2 years there as a software engineer working on Oracle's database replication engine, high performance computing, and stream processing. What were some of the valuable lessons that you learned from this first gig out of school?
Yeah, I had actually worked 6 months before my undergrad and my grad school here. But for 6 months, so I worked on a company called DSHA, which is a hedge fund. So working on trading systems, algorithmic training. And I got to implement some like Paxos style, like consensus algorithms there. But Oracle was my real full-time, like longer term, like job out of school, right? So I got to learn, Oracle database is like a really awesome piece of engineering, right? So I got to learn so much in terms of writing production code, around testing practices, release management. It's very easy to knock enterprise software and say it's boring, it's like whatever. But if you actually, from the inside, I got to see how much actually goes in to actually deliver something as stable. And people take Oracle for granted, right? So Oracle database, it's like a safe for your data, right? You put data in there, you can trust the thing with it. So I got to see the other side of, what does it take to build this level of mission critical data systems? And a little bit of a more side thing is that I got also interesting, I would say, a startup-y kind of like experience, because 2-3 months in, I joined the Oracle Streams team. And then 2 months in, they bought our competitor, basically. So for all 3 months, I kept hearing the team talk about a competitor. 3 months in, they bought that competitor, which was Golden Gate. So for us, then I also got into seeing firsthand how an M&A, like how this kind of like things go, navigating like a lot of uncertainty. And this is again like 2009, right? So with the recession and all of those things, so navigating a lot of uncertainty, and also at a personal level, and also when they were merging both systems, there were like lots of performance optimizations, a lot of different like engineering work that interesting work that came out of that integrations. So I actually, so a lot of them were fast paced because of the nature of the M&A and all of that. And I got to actually work on also building up how do you deliver impact incrementally? How do you like prioritize more vague, open-ended, complex problems? So I got a good taste for also things like that. It was a pretty interesting experience, not a run-of-the-mill first job, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting that you mentioned that part about learning about navigating uncertainty during an acquisition and the challenges of merging new codes integration, a new product into existing Oracle solution. Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of challenges with absorbing a completely new technical stack to the existing stack.
Yeah. Oracle had really optimized the Oracle to Oracle native integration, like replication, for a while, or like over a decade. And then Golden Gate presented, it can do heterogeneous databases. It can move from Oracle to MySQL, SQL Server DVD or whatever. So it does like lots of different, even product level, to like understand a lot, to be in that time and navigate that scenario. So I think, again, I mean, it was, even though it was like stressful in some senses, maybe at times, but looking back, I consider that experience actually taught me a lot of things that I otherwise would not have been exposed to.
Yeah, it sounds like to get out just the engineering mindset and also adopting a little bit of that digital product centric mindset.
Right.
Yep. Now, in late 2011, you joined LinkedIn as a senior software engineer, working primarily on Voldemort. And this is a distributed key value store that can handle a big chunk of traffic on LinkedIn and serve thousands of requests per second over terabytes of data, which I believe powers a lot of the main products LinkedIn that we are well known for. Well, first of all, can you tell about your decision to join LinkedIn at that stage? And also, would you mind sharing a couple of the high-level technical and operational challenges you encountered during both the development and scaling phase of Voldemort?
Yeah, so out of Oracle, I think I was mostly looking for an opportunity to work on an environment that was more faster-paced. So Oracle, you get to learn a lot of the distributed data, like fundamentals, you get a lot of these things. But like that was, if you look at it, the time when data was re-exploding, right? The terms data science were all like coined during that period. And companies like LinkedIn, Facebook, the whole like social and search like era out there, there's like lots of things going on and scale out distributed data systems. So I wanted to work on something like that in an environment, in a more consumer facing environment where I would kind of be able to iterate faster. With enterprise software, you obviously can move only with some speed. So that was my primary motivation. And as you, again, 2011, you didn't have DynamoDB or Spanner in the world, cloud Spanner in the world, right? You had either a data or DBMS, or you had some caches like Memcache, and that's basically what you had. And every company, I think the Bigtable and Dynamo papers had just come out, I think a year before or something like that. And then pretty much Facebook was building Cassandra, Hedgebase, and LinkedIn was building Voldemort. And so in that sense, yeah, it was again like super exciting. Voldemort was started by Jay Krebs at LinkedIn, and then he moved on to work on, focus more on Kafka. So when we joined the team, Voldemort was serving 10,000 QPS or something like that. And when I was leaving, I think that was 2014, we'd managed to scale the system up to like 2.5 million or 3 million QPS. And then this is the period also where LinkedIn grew from maybe 80, 70 million members to like north of 500 million, 600 million members with a lot more products and like a complete product revamp. So really the hyper growth phase of LinkedIn. I would say my LinkedIn experience is what really hardened me in terms of my operational skills. I realized that it's not good enough to be just a really good engineering-wise. You need to really understand the SRE function as well really well, and then be able to actually work closely with them and own a system as a service for the rest of the company. So that whole angle is what I learned at LinkedIn. Voldemort, we managed it as a what passes for like a cloud service today. Like we managed it as a multi-tenant service, and then meaning our team would manage all the clusters. We would do the capacity planning. We would do multi-tenancy controls, quotas. So we guarantee a certain level of performance and throughput and latency to the rest of the company. And then we keep planning ahead for all the features we work with product. That was again a really awesome experience for me. And LinkedIn was parallelly building a newer database system, which is now, I think, what they use, which is Espresso. And since most of their code was actually going towards Espresso, this Voldemort team was like pretty small. It was like three people. And then, you know, I basically got to own the entire end-to-end read-write performance and like client monitoring. It was like awesome. Like I had like way too much responsibility probably for my pay grade at that point. But I really enjoyed it. I think it was a little bit daunting at times, but looking back, after a point, I was like, I just want to make the best out of this. And then we ended up scaling Voldemort really well, actually, for the company. And technical challenges wise as well, beyond maybe Google at that point, I don't think any company had really scaled, maybe Amazon for Dynamo, had really scaled key value stores to that level. LinkedIn, Facebook are all learning to do, like scale, how to scale like distributed databases. So that was like really fun. There was, as you can imagine, tons of operational issues. There's so many mistakes I made in production. I was like 2 hours away from like taking down LinkedIn in share, like the new share articles. And I learned so many, I got burned so many times in production. I got so many scars and so many things I learned out of it. Introduction of new technologies, like today, SSDs are everywhere, right? Today, lot of people, backend engineers, at least know RocksDB, and then they understand like all these log structured databases. These were all like brand new, not in, in terms of in LevelDB had just come out. There was just BerkeleyDB if you want to look at embedded databases back then. So all these technology trends, like new storage engines on top of new storage SSD, there are so many new technical things to learn as well. For example, we realized that once you make the disk faster, the bottleneck shifts to CPU and garbage collection, because the SSDs are so fast and all of the code was like fine creating objects till that point, because the old, the spinning disks were very slow, right? Once you throw an SSD in there, your latency goes from tens of milliseconds to like a microsecond, then your bottleneck is on CPU. So they're like very interesting things that we learned in also that whole like hardware, as the hardware shifted. I consider those 3 years to actually be like when I really learned production, like on how to actually shoulder that responsibility for a company like LinkedIn.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for talking about the period and these key learnings. We're picking up new technologies as well as understanding that some of the operational burdens running production level system. And I was curious what happened with Voldemort after you left, and what's the state of that project?
I think there's maybe a few large open source users out there today, but I don't think LinkedIn runs it anymore. I think they migrated it out to that new database system that they were building. For us, I think towards the end of my time there is where I started looking for newer things to fix as well, because Voldemort was in like a really good shape, right? We at that point, we either had to add more features to Voldemort beyond the simple key value storage. The simple key value storage, it can do really well. It can give you across all stores, we are able to achieve even at that QPS, less than a millisecond P95 and stuff. So we really operated really well. So now you have to either introduce new query types, maybe do range query support, things like that, introduce transactions, or you have to really like extend the database at that point. But LinkedIn had already made the choice to build a newer system. And then there was like a team working on it. So it is pretty much reaching end of life. And that's actually how I was trying to do the private cloud project that we had at LinkedIn, because the idea there was, we have managed to run Kafka and Voldemort well here for the company, but the user onboarding experience is not, it's basically wiki pages and Jira tickets. So how can we like build, and there is no elasticity there, right? It's still, you have to file tickets to SRE teams and approve it, that approach. There's like a lot of like manual provisioning, these kind of things. So the idea there was, okay, what does it take to build a like a public cloud like experience for what it was back then, but for all the LinkedIn data infrastructure services internally? That was the idea. I think it was a pretty good idea, I think, but it didn't, at least we started the project, we built the first version out, but my heart was actually with data infrastructure. I wanted to build the next data system. And then that's where actually I decided to leave LinkedIn.
Thanks a lot for talking about that experience building the private cloud at LinkedIn. It sounds like you learned a thing or two about what your interests are, because you mentioned a bit that you want to dive deeper into the database data architecture direction with your career. After LinkedIn and a brief stint working at Box, you joined Uber in late 2014 as a founding engineer on Uber's data team and architect of Uber's data architecture. Why did you decide to make this career transition?
So, like I mentioned, I was looking for the challenge on the data side, and I went to Box actually because they had plans back then to build Google suite or like Office 365, like an entire suite of real-time collaborative apps. If you notice, they have a Box Notes project. So I joined that team. And then the idea was, oh, we'll build a new database backend, like a real-time collaborative block-based editor, like what with Notion today, right? So I was pretty excited to go work on operational transforms, build like a real-time or a Firebase database backend to power all these different apps. I thought this would be like a cool project. The cloud service like Box mixed the best of both worlds, right? It had the operational aspects of it. I can iterate faster on a managed service, and but it was also selling that to real customers, not just internal customers like LinkedIn, but also selling it like software over the wire to companies out there. And yeah, it was like super exciting for me there. But unfortunately, I think the company decided to not pursue fund that project in that way. That to this date, they only have Box Notes. And since that project was scrapped and pretty much like that took a lot of the original scope that I was planning to change my edition there. And then then I started interviewing again. I wanted to get back in the data distributed data infrastructure kind of space. That's where I thought I belonged. Incidentally, I knew about Uber, but I was actually interviewing with Snapchat and for my interview, they gave me like a Uber coupon to take a ride from the airport to, they were in Venice Beach in LA. And I think I would have been the 15th engineer in Snap working on the first full-time infrastructure hire, not just data, but like cloud and like the whole thing. It was like very interesting, exciting times there as well. But I took an Uber and then I was like instantly fell in love with the product. I was like, oh my God, this is so amazing. And now tying back, I had spent nights and weekends and all of my RA time driving around cars and optimizing all sorts of mobile communication and these kinds of things. Yeah, that and then the fact that I don't know how to explain the magic of Uber's product. So yeah, I instantly fell in love and I was like, I should look at Uber. And then I actually went and spoke to Uber. I also spoke to the likes of Airbnb and like other companies. But for me, what was really interesting about the Uber opportunity was it was a blank slate, meaning like they just had some Python script, like a Vertica warehouse, and that's it. And then I could see how the company and the product could evolve and what all interesting real-time challenges and all these things that could actually throw up, right? Like these challenges could come in, and I felt I want to be an early member on this ground floor opportunity at Uber. And that's actually how I ended up picking Uber. And I wanted to actually have the opportunity to build the data architecture for a very large company, large business, and shoulder a company level responsibility. And then something that will make the technical decisions at that kind of level. And that was like a great opportunity for me.
Absolutely. I'm curious, in 2014, what was the state of Uber as a business? And also, what was the state of data architecture of Uber when you first joined, just to kind of paint?
Yeah. I think Uber was booking multiple billions in gross bookings already, 2014. And I was, I think, less than the first 200 engineers there. And at least all of the engineering would fit in one floor when I joined. And then we're hiring really fast at that point as well. And then Uber moves really fast. Like they build like a lot of new products, like very quickly experiment. The company's DNA was like they experiment a lot, things like that. So we were starting to feel that the yearly like pains around as you hire more people, as you build more product, there's explosion in data. All of that was beginning to be there. The data team was, I think, before I joined, there were three people before me, and two of them are working on this ETL system, which was Python, Celery queues, stuff like that to run ETLs on like Vertica basically. And then we put out dashboards and then people can query the warehouse or they can build some basic dashboards. That's basically where things were. I think, and just the interesting thing to understand is Uber is unlike LinkedIn, like they're very different. At LinkedIn, a lot of the data challenges when we are around, because LinkedIn builds all these recommended products and things like that, a lot of the users were actually engineers for data. And then you had a smaller set of like analysts who would like optimize for sales. And LinkedIn, end of the day, is like a very large enterprise business as well, right? Not just other ads. And it's a very, very like unique company in that sense. But Uber had a lot of people who are running cities, and they're not like technical at all, right? They're like super smart. That's not what I mean, but they're very entrepreneurial. They can run with things. They would learn SQL and actually write SQL on the warehouse directly. But as you can imagine, writing like performance SQL on a warehouse is not a, like an easy thing. So we had to actually be, the data team had to be this buffer between all the engineers who are building products, producing data, and all the operations folks who are consuming the data and making sense of what's going on. And Uber would, as like the strategy was optimized city by city, right? Hyperlocal would run like local campaigns specific to each city. And that was like very unique. And then it meant that we had to build data as a product within the company. I know like we talked, it gets talked about it a lot. We didn't call it all this back then, but like we had to build as if we are building to an external audience of end users within the company. And the infrastructure was nowhere like close to where we wanted to be, right? Because all we could do was store data in a warehouse. So my first year there was pretty much doing all the basic things, right? I introduced, upgrade our Kafka versions, introduce like database things, capture, make log event collection very reliable, scale Kafka across multiple data centers. And Uber, like, even then we wanted to run on Uber entered China. So we were running in 4 data centers there, 4 in the US. We were running 8 data centers. And then we had to now deal with like DR. How do you merge data from every place consistently? All kinds of like issues early on. So we designed the first 1.5 years was just designing these things. And we got to a state where, okay, we could, people could do stream processing using Flink, or I think back in the day it was like Samza or something. And you could, there's a basic Hadoop cluster with some Hive tables, and you could do run Spark. This is Spark 1.3, by the way, like it's very old. Everything was just coming up, right? Mm-hmm. And we actually managed to scale it to a point where, okay, we could store a lot of data on the Hadoop cluster, and then we would ETL something into Vertica, which will actually give us the performance for reporting, and then all the other use cases would stay there. We managed to make it work, I would say, and actually arrest this problem. We also focused a lot on the productizing part that I talked about, which is building the equivalent of schema registry in-house at Uber. There is a very easy way. As a Uber engineer, you show up, you go write a schema for the data that you want to produce, punch a button, the Kafka topics, the tables all get created for you, data is flowing in, and we built all these services that can now manage those tables. You don't have to come and hand you a bunch of things. So we really built a layer of abstraction between the engineers and the end product, the city ops people, and they could just have conversations at the high level and not be dealing with, you know, ad hoc data requests and like debugging queries together or things like that. So that's like what the first 1.5 years at Uber looked like.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for painting that the picture, serving as a layer between the data producer and data consumer. Like that abstraction allowed them to communicate better. So it sounds like you started Uber with a blank slate and really doing the basic thing in the first year, and then the evolution happening as the requirement requests become more impactful. Based on your experience building data infrastructure at Uber, in 2016, I came across this article you wrote on O'Reilly.
Yeah.
Talking about, you basically argue that there's a need to add more incremental processing primitives to existing Hadoop technologies. And this is related to the part I just mentioned, your answer about some of the early technologies Uber used for stream processing and sort of the trying out new primitives, right?
Yeah.
Could you mind unpacking some of the most relevant takeaway from that?
Yeah. So I think after we reached like some sort of state of the art, okay, this is what everybody was implementing, but we'd actually managed to do it in a way at Uber where we can get really good streaming data latencies till the Hadoop cluster. And that's where we faced a lot of kind of impedance mismatch. So as you can see, I have worked already on batch data systems, if you will, where they're doing like a lot of some massively parallel data processing, as well as in Oracle and with LinkedIn, I already gotten exposed a lot to stream processing as well. And with Voldemort, I already, you know, I've seen like pieces of all these problems before. So for me, a key challenge and the takeaway of that article was, if you look at the programming model in stream processing, you consume an event or a new change that happened, and you take the new change, propagate it through your computation. Let's say you're just counting the number of trips that happened in every city for the last hour. Okay, a new trip happens, you take it, you add it to a previous result that you have, and you publish a new value out. That's stream processing. That's how stream processing works, right? But if you look at how all of the Hadoop batch processing, and then by and large, they all maybe even work like that even today with even all this lakehouse and everything. This is the part that we haven't spent a lot about and outside of Hadoop. It's like you periodically, the model was always periodically you would run a job, which will go bulk, read a whole bunch of files and then do some processing, write a whole bunch of files. And essentially there was no incrementality. So we basically thought, okay, if we take the programming model that we have in stream processing, which is new data arrives, how do you reconcile it into an existing intermediate result and emit changes outside? Can't we bring this on top of kind of horizontally scalable storage and compute, right? Which is like what YARN and let's say HDFS Pro will provide you, or today Kubernetes and S3 will provide you, right? So that was the key idea behind that article. And we called it incremental data processing to differentiate from stream processing, right? Because in stream processing, there's something continuously running and it's continuously streaming something, right? Here, the idea would be that you would still run on-demand horizontal compute, but they would run far more frequently and far more incrementally, where let's say every 5 minutes, a job would wake up and then it would go process new trips in the last 5 minutes and then update them onto the trips table. Exactly like how the Oracle to Oracle or Golden Gate replication would work. You would replicate trips from here, and then that's streaming. It'll keep applying it as it happens. But for analytics, it like we felt by doing this kind of like still sticking to this kind of like a mini batch kind of model, we get a lot of efficiency because we can write data in columnar formats, yeah, which improves query performance a lot. I actually thought you don't get many problems in computer science or in databases where you get to reduce costs and also make things faster. Usually in databases, you throw money at it to make it go faster, right? In this scenario, the existing old school batch processing was so naive and like very rudimentary and unoptimized that we could actually just incrementalize all of it, and we are actually able to save millions and millions of dollars for the business, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for providing some motivation behind the dash and go even incremental processing. In that same article, you also have a section on some of the challenges with incremental processing and trade-off between completeness and latency. There's a shipping mindset, and most importantly, there's a lot of primitives for incremental processing. And to fulfill the vision from that article, you came across this talk that you gave at Datacastle back in 2017 about later it's renamed like Hudi within you.
Yeah.
And this is an open source incremental processing framework built Uber to enable faster data for petabyte scale and data analytics. So continuing on the thread that you just mentioned from your previous answer, can you go over the initial design and implementation of Hudi across the Hadoop ecosystem at Uber?
Yeah, so just taking off of what we were talking about, I think we distilled all of that, just three things that probably we need to build. Essentially, we wanted to build the ability to transactionally update or like actually mutate data in tables, right? This would be very similar to what stream processing state stores would do. If you look at Flink or Spark Streaming, all of them have state stores where you can take a new record and then like incrementally apply an update, right? So we have to build that and also the ability to emit the change to for downstream processing, which is chain streams and change capture. So we essentially started designing Hudi as a database abstraction. So this is basically, we thought this is a database problem. We take HDFS and we build a transactional database layer on top. And instead of rebuilding the query engine, right, we didn't want to build one more query engine, right, from scratch. We said, okay, like at that point, you had Hive, which is really good for really large batch jobs. And it's like reliability is the main thing, not speed. And we had Spark, which was really picking up a lot of steam in data science and generally starting to eat into the ETL space. And then you had Presto, which, you know, is really, really good for interactive query performance, right? So we picked Design Hudi as this layer and then integrated this into being queryable from all these three different agents. And that's how Hudi was designed. And I think, yeah, we can talk about this later, but from there, I think it's evolved, taken its life on of its own in the Apache software foundation to like grown into what it is today. But that's how we began.
Perfect. Yeah. Thanks for going over the context a little bit. 2017 is when the project got open source. And so between 2015 and 2017 is the time where it's the initial ideas is incubated like in-house, right?
We actually incubated the article, if you notice, came out 2016. By 2016, we were already actually building it in. By end of 2016, Uber's core, we would ingest external operational databases into a set of Hudi tables on the lake. Then we would incrementally transform them into more derived, your regular fact dimension, star schema kind of tables. Also incrementally, this thing was being done for all the core critical business critical data sets by end of 2016. Then we thought, okay, I think this feels like a general purpose problem that most people have. And then we outsourced the project very early 2017 so that we can start building it out more in open source. And yeah, we had used, till that point, we had used so much software from Apache Software Foundation to build out like Kafka and Parquet and WordSpark and whatnot. So we wanted to also give back to open source. So that was why we open sourced it very early on back then.
Yeah. So it was open source in by Uber in 2017. And eventually Hudi was incubated into the Apache Software Foundation in 2019. Now, my question is twofold. First, could you mind walking through the evolution of Hudi throughout this period, building in public? And second of all, what lesson have you learned about establishing standards for open source dev projects?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So actually, I would love to tell you that our 2017 open source, everybody instantly got it. That was not the case, actually. So when we originally did that, we had a lot of these internal conversations inside Uber as well, because like Hadoop and like people had gotten used to immutability on the lake. And then when we said, okay, you can now update things, it wasn't like really, if you read the Crossing the Chasm book, like they talk about the visionaries and how it grows, we actually had mostly the visionaries in 2017 who were all like thinking, okay, I have a database change capture problem and I'm going to take the extra step to go and like optimize the solution. They were like looking for innovative solutions. So a lot of that happened in 2017. And then we were actually slowly getting the software to also run outside of Uber's infrastructure in a more general purpose way, like decouple, like all of those things. It got also sanitized and hardened that way. And 2018, I would say there's a lot more community adoption. The thing became a lot more generally usable. Things grew to a point where in 2019, people felt like, okay, wait, this is like a storage system and we want neutral governance for the project, because if we adopt this, we're going to put all of our company's data into this thing. So that's when we realized, okay, the right place for this is the Apache Software Foundation, where there are like strict norms and rules and like a lot of existing established practices to ensure projects are governed in a kind of like a vendor neutral or in a fair, inclusive way. it was a journey about the incubation itself. And in terms of standards, I think, yeah, it's a very interesting question. What we realized actually was that when we implemented this, I mentioned that, for example, that we integrated into three engines, right? So what we saw was there wasn't really like a good standard API or anything that you would, all of these engines would support. Then you can be like, go change that one thing and they all recognize a new table. It wasn't there, right? Today, I think the situation is slightly like better, but even today there is no real standard per se. Each engine has their, like they have better APIs, individual APIs, but that is the other thing that we, SQL language level, even there is like more standardization now than what this was before. But beyond that, everything is pretty like non-standard. And then everything is like a more, you know, that's where we felt. And we tried to, so to that end, this needs, it's not a problem that we can solve by ourselves, right? We'd happily participate in any standardization effort. But to that end, what we've done in Huri, as we build it, we try to actually take this integration pain out of the users. We try to build a lot more platformization into the product, make it like easy to get started. We build also not just the deep transactional layers, but we also make some upper level applications that like a streaming ingest application or ETL app, like things like that would make the overall end-to-end use case easy in Huri as well.
I want to follow up on your answers with two extra questions. So the first part about the idea of crossing the chasm from the Uber to eventually got into the Apache Software Foundation, you mentioned how do you try to keep it like vendor neutral? Because I suppose that at the beginning, a lot of people associate Huri with Uber, but yeah, like can you tell more about like how do you actually make the project to be
vendor neutral? Got it. Even today, if you generally look at the governance structure for Apache, I don't think we do anything very special. Like a lot of this credit should go to ASF. There is like governance in place where there's a project management committee and there's like a PMC chair. The PMC chair reports to the board. And if let's say, for example, somebody thinks a particular cloud vendor is getting preferential treatment or something like that, then they can actually go and raise it up with the board and we are answerable. And the software, the licensing, all of that is owned by the software foundation, not by any individuals. And there are lots of cases of even individuals and PMC members being asked to leave if they violate the code of conduct. So Apache is like pretty strict in enforcing these kinds of things. So there is that, right? But and also the way you make decisions in open source, if this kind of central governance model, everybody gets to vote and make a plus or minus one decisions on it. We have out of the, I may not get the exact number right, but out of the, let's say the 15, 16, like PNC members, let's say one house art company just has four, right? So it's not, even though like, oh, what else, the hoodie company, we don't control the project or anything in any way. There are PMC members from other cloud providers, other large technology companies out there. So we can't go there. As an example, we can't just go and make a code change. And let's say we can't go and reject another PR just because we are commercializing that exact functionality in our product. And then we want to like not have it in open source, and this kind of thing won't pass muster. So there's like a lot of practices like this that help the community advance and keep the spirit of open source, but also checks and balances to make sure that the project is not cannibalized by one particular vendors or companies.
Yeah, thanks for talking about that governance structure and to make sure that the project stay vendor neutral. And then you mentioned about the change with open standard a little bit, and Huri already did the lab work for the users by doing the integration already so that the users can just leverage that. Just looking a little bit in your big picture of open source standard, like what do you hope to have in that space? Was there any other project that you think doing a good job, or was any best practices that you think can make up a standard with Mariality?
So I would say there are some good projects in the data space. For example, the Open Lineage project tries to define a more standard open protocol for lineage, because if you look at data lineage, what happens is many parts of the company can adopt like different systems, but the thing is only useful if you have lineage holistically, right? So there are efforts like that, and OpenTelemetry is a great one, right? As you know, from like, it's not in the analytics space, but it's still in the like the data collection sort of like ecosystem. I feel, again, so my background also, I've also been like on the backend OLTP side of things, not just on analytics. I always felt like, let's say JVM, right? JVM is a standard, correct? Like it's a standard. So many vendors can implement the same standard. That's what standards are supposed to be. I think in the data line, I've seen that standard being loosely used to refer to, oh, I'm a popular project, right? For example, like Kafka is a very popular, like a really popular pub sub system, right? But it's not per se the standard. Like it's the most popular implementation, and maybe the Kafka protocol could be standardized. So I don't see a lot of like standardization efforts that way. Like looking inward to, let's say, Hoodie, and now I wish, let's say, okay, pre-Hoodie, right? Now there is like Hoodie, Delta Lake, and Iceberg, and like the three projects like in similar spaces with very deep technical differentiations, maybe, but similar-ish. Some parts are similar. You know, if you look at it, they all serve metadata, like it's all done in different ways. Before this, before the transactional, like all of this, we had Hive, which everybody knocks on, but it wasn't really a standard, but there's something there where it clearly provided an abstraction between writing data and then you can read that table, correct? If you, I wish like when people talk through standards, this is visual thinking and all, like maybe, but people actually talk about standards and separate, not use it in a marketing sense and be like, oh, I'm the de facto standard for something. That, I think, causes a lot of fragmentation, in my opinion. Just to take you through this mix, right? There are three, let's say, storage systems, and now you need to integrate this with, you know, some Phi engines, and then each of these things support some a snapshot query, like a time travel query, a incremental query, like 3-4 query types. If you just explore this matrix out, these are the number of combinations that people have, right, to deal with. With Hive, there was one query and Phi engines, and that's basically it. You're like Phi thing. Now you have 50 things in some sense. So looking back, maybe even like critiquing myself, I think maybe we could have done more to make things more standardized. But that's basically why I think, in a nutshell, I feel the standardization efforts are some healthy ones, but there isn't enough of that standardization in the data space. As much as you find in the on the backend side, any framework can speak REST. Right? REST is, you know, some things are standard. They can all talk to each other in some common language. That isn't there.
Yeah. Thanks for walking through that. The question about open standards. So throughout your 4.5 years at Uber, you also have scaled engineering processes and honed operational excellence across various areas of engineering to ultimately keep Uber available and reliable, while engineering grew from 200 to more than 4,000. So what were some of the valuable leadership lessons that you absorbed during this period?
Yeah, Uber was a really fun, you know, like experience. And I think I realized that there's a lot more to like engineering leadership as well, purely as even if I'm just an IC role. Yeah, I think the biggest thing, we were able to translate a lot of the operational best practices, like and keeping, and not just to keep like uptime and availability and everything, also to keep your team happy and sustainable practices. Like during big call, don't deploy code on a Friday, not big changes, like leave things alone for the weekend, and don't leave if there's a lot of people, like vacation time or whatever, don't deploy, right? Just do a code freeze. There like plenty of kind of operational aspects that we translated and implemented it at scale. And also tons of like execution lessons for me. This was my first time driving projects and large initiatives that spanned many teams, right? I had to write roadmaps for that kind of affected like 100 engineers that scale. Being cognizant about also like understanding how to even scope those. You can't make it per way, like, but also you need to make it ambitious enough. You're like balancing all of that was like really valuable. And at the people level, I think the biggest thing I learned at Uber, because Uber attract was a melting pot of some of the best engineering talent that's, you know, we had people coming from like Facebook, LinkedIn, Amazon, Google's, like every really awesome company. But across all of them, one thing I saw was that it basically boils down to people. Like people really need to think that their projects are step up for them, and they need to like sport that attitude. And I saw folks who did that really succeeded, while some people with even like really great track record, like they've done like amazing things in the past, but like some of them, they were approaching Uber as a continuation of where they were before and didn't realize that this is a new mountain that they need to start climbing from the ground up. And some of them didn't do well as well as they could have. So I also got a lot of lessons to not take people. People can grow, place trust in people to grow, and also for myself not to be complacent. If I do one project well, doesn't really mean that I'll do the succeed at that. Right? I learned that by watching.
Thanks a lot for going over some of that lessons that you learned at Uber, both from the technical side as well as some of the operational and people level lesson. And I'm sure this valuable leadership lesson can serve you a lot in your current role, which your new startup I will talk about later on in your conversation. But before talking about the Hoodie project in detail, I want to talk about your big period working at Confluent as a principal engineer on the Facebook DB project, which makes it easy to create event streaming application. Yeah, would you mind kind of explaining some of the, you know, the motivation to first join Confluent and also working on this project and just high level design of it? Yeah.
Got it. Yeah. So joining Confluent, I think mostly was a creation. A lot of the LinkedIn crew, Confluent, we work very closely during our time at LinkedIn. So we can talk about it a little bit more. At that time, I'd actually wanted to start some company or at least like work full time on Hoodie even back then. So I was like mostly exploring different ways. So I at least Confluent took me to a company where I was working on data infrastructure as a service in cloud. So I felt like, okay, I'll at least get to learn a lot in terms of cloud data infrastructure while helping Confluent with these things, and also work with some of my older like LinkedIn colleagues again. That's how Confluent happened. And I landed right on the KSQL team. And KSQL was an already existing project. And essentially that was a SQL project where essentially you write SQL and it will translate into streaming SQL pipelines. But the idea with KSQL DB was, and which is having seen the streaming data architectures for the last 4 years, and most of this ideas should be directly related to J. And the thing is, there's a lot of complexity in the architecture, right? Typically, you need to run like a stream processing applications and then marry it with an external sync and then get like an application built end-to-end. Like, let's say you are detecting fraud. You would usually do some computation to score, let's say, transactions for fraud score, and you would then need to serve it out into another database so that you can build an application where, let's say, customer service reps or somebody looks at these transactions and they can flag them and they can score them, look at them more. That's how a typical fraud application pipeline looks like, right? The idea with KSQL was, okay, what if we build one system that can actually do all of this. It understands streaming data as a first-class citizen and can also now unlock like very interactive and these kind of like real-time OLTP applications that you build. And to that end, essentially, we made a rebrand of the project and introduced a lot of database features in KSQL. Like, for example, serving it, the initial version, it was behaving more like a key value store. It reported some range queries. So basically, some NoSQL kind of store where you can write, and then you could do all of this in SQL. You could write a SQL to define your computation, then you could write SQL to query the data. And then just in one system packaged together. That was the main basic idea behind KSQL. And I think we called it a streaming database. And now I think with Materialize and also Flink, there's a lot of similar efforts around this at Flink. There's actually like a technology category right now around this.
Yeah, this sounds like you'll be able to expand your knowledge about the whole streaming data application system just by working at Confluent and be at the forefront of this technology.
And I think like there's a long way to go. It's still green field in my opinion, where by and large, if you look at microservice architectures today, they use a queue like Kafka or Pulsar or RabbitMQ or something like that and marry it with another database, correct? And then most of the applications are built like that, where your microservice has its own database, two set of tables, and then it will notify another service through these queues. So the streaming database idea is how can you abstract a queue and a database into a single system and similarly reduce complexity in your microservice. So that is the North Star. And there's like lots of work to be done to head to that part.
Perfect. Yeah. And I think that's also might be relevant to my next question, which tie that experience up, like even streaming that way with some of your current work with Hudi. Throughout this whole period, after even leaving Uber and spend time at Confluent, you continue be part of the Apache Hudi project, it's a PMC, and working on it. In July 2021, you wrote this very in-depth article articulating the vision for Apache Hudi and describing it as a streaming data-like platform built out of a database kernel. Can you elaborate on this notion of the streaming data lake platform?
Yeah, so that's a great question. If you look at it, like initially when we covered even the motivations for data processing and everything, right? So what we are really trying to do was build the streaming programming model, which is to do everything more incrementally, consume new input, compute new output incrementally with the batch data infrastructure, which is tables living on top of data lake storage in cloud or HDFS on-prem, being accessible to all these different lake engines like Spark, Presto, like Hive, like Trino and whatnot. So I think Hudi still makes a lot of design choices across the board towards just enabling this the higher level programming model. When we initially build Hudi, we called it a transactional data lake. So that is talking about it at the storage level, what Hudi provides. It's like the technical capabilities, it provides transactions for you. It acts like a database for you on the lake. But what we want to build and we built a ton of them already, are lots of platform components on top of this like core transactional layer. And end to end, you'll be able to build these incremental or like this kind of streaming, what we call the streaming data lake. For example, if you look at the Hudi stack that we put out in the same article, right? It goes like layer by layer and explains this. So at the lowest layer, you have cloud, like lake storage and like open file formats like Parquet, H5, ORC, Avro, what have you. And what Hudi really provides is the transaction layer on top. So it provides a way for you to organize your data and track schema versions. It tracks partitioning. It has a lot of metadata around what are your file lists, like what file listings and things to scale access to this table. What is like the table format layer, if you will. Essentially, encode every information about a table in a very scalable, accessible way, right? But beyond that, we already provide advanced concurrency control mechanisms. At this point, some 7 or 8 indexing mechanisms so that you can quickly update the data, right? Because that's so key to the incremental programming model. And then we are also building out server components, like going back to the same analogy, right? Like a raw, like a state store or RocksDB or any embeddable state store in stream processing would have some kind of cache to accelerate the merge process and all of that, right? So we're building like a caching service. We're building a meta server. All these like platform components are also built, and together they are the database layer, as we will. It supports a lot of readers and writers in standard SQL or programmatic interfaces. We define keys, all different kinds of like queries and like writers are supported. And then we also have a whole bunch of what we call platform services on top, which is streaming ingestion. Like you can, there's a single command that you can run where you can point at a like a S3 bucket or a Kafka topic or a database, and you run that and then you'll get query tables built for you, right? So this is the platformizing part of the technology as well. So you've not just built the core, the database kernel to do all this like advanced stuff, but we want to unlock the upper level use cases. And where I think the project stands today, if you ask me, is we've, I think, successfully like made incremental data ingestion the norm and the de facto way of doing things on the lake today. If you look at starting from Uber, Robinhood, Walmart, Amazon.com, Zoom that you're on right now, and all of them have used Hoodie, and I'm pretty like Philips and GE. Like I'm leaving out so many large enterprises. Pharma companies like AstraZeneca, like all of them have used to stream sort of data in very quickly into a lake, and Hoodie can absorb all these updates very quickly. And we've also platform, and most of them use these platform services, right? Directly. They're not building custom integrations and stuff. It's not a, so that's the vision in the streaming data platform vision. We want to continue contributing to Hoodie and to make it like a place where a project that you can start with, and it gives you deep technology, but also gives you all these different like bells and whistles that you can easily go to production with. And that is the mission that we are painting.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for going over all the details in that piece. And also thanks for stepping to each layer of the Hoodie stack that you described in that post. And I'll be sure to include the image of the stack into the show notes as well. And listeners and readers, take a look and learn more about this app, the project. Just out of curiosity, out of these 11 different layers of that stack, which layer, I guess, the most challenging to build, top of mind for you and the creators?
Yeah, definitely a lot of the deeper database challenges are around indexing concurrency control, I would say. The table format layer is pretty, there are only like few ways to do it. But concurrency control and indexes, there are like open problems there. For example, a lot of people, when they talk about lakehouse technologies, or like that's kind of what the trade name for this technology is today, they compare it to databases. But, and when I say databases, like an Oracle, OLTP kind of database, right? But having worked on 2-3 of them, actually written code in those code bases, I can basically like be very confident in stating that these problems are very different. Specifically, writing to a database table is a throughput problem, while writing to something like Voldemort was like a latency problem. You do millions of operations per second there, right? Like a data lake is not going to do a million transactions per second. Oracle, if you look at those systems, they would, you know, do TPS. That's how they measure themselves, transactions per second. So these are very different systems. So the concurrency control and a lot of these different things have to be designed very differently. And that is where I feel stream processing is where we need to borrow more from for this specific type of database rather than this. And for me, I think I've been really fortunate also to have been, like you mentioned, part of KSQL and the streaming database story as well.
Yeah.
In the gap that we started from leaving Uber to starting OneHouse, that really cemented my kind of like thesis on this as well.
Yeah.
It's a really different problem, I think.
And I also saw that you have published a couple of blog posts on this problem. There's a blog post that you wrote about like how concurrency control, and there's also like a couple of blog posts on the Hudi website about capabilities on, I think, like multi-model indexing and asynchronous indexing, to be exact. So it sounds like this is incremental updates that your team always try to improve as the product evolves.
Correct. This is the core essence of the product. I think when people compare these class of technologies outside, they usually write a table with integration, check marks, like tick mark, X marks, like this. But for the things that stand the test of time are subtle design trade-offs like these in data systems, where you operate, you optimize for more lock-free kind of concurrency control, then maybe you're writing a little bit more metadata, right? Another system which is optimized for, let's say, like batch pipelines could be just writing fewer metadata, but it may not be able to take on those many updates, correct? I think there are still so many subtle trade-offs and technology challenges here in this space to solve. And that's also something that we look forward to contributing more and more to Hudi. Hudi's core essence will stay around how do we incrementalize every single batch job out there. That's the core mission for us.
Yeah, thanks for emphasizing on that mission again. Talking about product updates, I believe that the Hudi community strives to deliver major release every 2 or 3 months while offering minor release every month. So my question is twofold. Firstly, how does your team prioritize the Hudi roadmap while developing an open source project? And then secondly, what have you learned about engaging the open source community?
Yeah, like two pretty broad questions, actually. Roadmap planning, I think it's very interesting. And it's actually very challenging also to do in a very distributed, in an open source community way, right? That is why we have these official expectations set to the community, and we try to do our best to hit them. So in terms of roadmap planning, again, going back, it's all very transparent. There is a dev list, like usually there's a mailing list in which somebody starts a thread on, hey, look, we're going to do this big major release. What features do we want to talk about? Then there is like a debate around, hey, do we do this feature in this release or the other release? Do we sequence it this way, that way? Bulk of my job, and it just kind of is what people think that it takes a lot to just do this coordination. Like my bulk of my job is to facilitate and sequence it, iron out, and make things running smooth. There's agreement and alignment across these priorities. And then we can do it in a way that the releases are stable, high quality, delivered on time. And usually we have this discussion, and then one of the committers or, you know, PMC members is nominated as the release manager. From that point onwards, the release manager has all authority, like to decide around the release. And I don't think I've ever overridden the release manager ever so far. It's basically the release manager's call, right? What typically happens, the development happens. As we talk, we have the 0.12 code freeze coming up next week. The release manager is going to make the call on when to cut the release candidate. And then once there is a release candidate out for the release, we put it out for voting in the community. People can vote plus one, minus one. If they think, oh, this is breaking my production, this is not good, then we debate on those again. Sometimes, oh, is there a workaround? It's like a small issue. We categorize them. We try to have that discussion. By and large, we proceed when there are, you know, the minus ones are resolved and there are like at least three plus ones or something like that from the PMC. And yeah, it's a pretty awesome collaborative process. It takes a lot of energy, time to put towards the community to deliver this as well. And yeah, what we learned is actually community appreciates all of this. That is what we appreciated. We do a lot around Hudi community. There is tens of thousands of Slack messages that we answer in the last year. And then there's usually a PMC contributor or a committer, somebody who's, we share the load every week to answer questions on Slack. we have north of 2,200 Slack members at this point, I think. And we have people who can answer, use, can support, report support issues on GitHub issues. Then there's a process to triage them, turn them into actual product technical Jiras that we can fix later on, things like that. We've seen that a lot of times users, we get data engineers who are really good with SQL and Spark and Python and like cranking out data pipelines, but not necessarily with a lot of deeper database knowledge. So we try to also spend a lot of time in certain like cases, provide suggestions. We try to maintain a good fact that people can understand questions like, hey, I want good update performance. This is my workload pattern. What do we do? We try to keep it generally useful for everybody.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of work just interacting with this community frequently. Yes. I believe they also community calls where people can host office hours to question.
Correct. The weekly office hours as well. And then we have a lot of support channels to this. And so far, we're not like, for us one house, we're not, this is all like, that's the main thing. Like, we will still want to keep a hoodie open. The community shouldn't see a lot of different changes. We're still keeping it.
Yeah. So, a great transition. So, let's take off your engineering hat and put on your father hat. So, since January of 2021, you have been the founder and CEO of a new startup called One House, which came up still in February 2022. One House is a cloud-native, fully managed lighthouse service built on Apache Hadoop. Can you share the story behind the founding of the company?
Yeah, this is like a good one. For me, personally, this was when we started Hadoop back at Uber. It was like a pretty controversial idea. Right? It was like pretty much all the traditional Hadoop people weren't happy that you're suddenly introducing updates into what was for 10 years immutable file storage. But as the thing gained more and more, like I got more validation, like you said, I went through the incubation project. It was pretty clear to me that this is the way forward for data architectures. And we saw that this is like a very powerful kind of new architecture that we can bring to the world. And this needed, and given how competitive the space is, like a lot of big players like Databricks, it was pretty clear that we wanted to advance the technology in Hadoop and also solve some, the opportunity to solve some real problems for the users out there. And for me, I was actually mentally ready to start, or at least start working on Hadoop full-time, see valid leads in 2019. But I didn't have my, like the papers to like green card or anything to pursue and start a company back then. So actually, my time at Confluent, the 1.5 years, and all of these good people that I work with actually, you know, kind of wrote letters for me and then helped me actually get a green card. And then we finally started the company in 2021. And those, I think, 2 years was probably like very tough to navigate for us because of the pandemic. Like, we lost, it basically sucked up all the free open source time. Like I just mentioned, all this community work, this was just weekends and nights for 4 years for us. So all of that dried up. So yeah, it was like a struggle to get to a point to start the company. But yeah, and the motivation, so why would you even do it, right? Beyond advancing Hadoop and the tech, what's the problem state? What's the business problem that we want to solve? Because every company needs to have a business problem that they solve, not just technology, right? So what we observed in the 4 years of doing this kind of community interaction with Hadoop is that exact thing that I talked about. Most companies invariably start with a warehouse, which is pretty close, but it's fully managed, right? And then they pick a fully managed ingest system. They essentially click buttons to get to a point where there is data in Snowflake, BigQuery, Redshift, or something where they can write SQL on, right? And then build some dashboards. And usually after that, what happens is it starts to break down. Either cost starts ballooning, even at medium scale. You want to start a data science team, and then none of this stuff really works well there. You need Spark, and you need all your PySpark and all this other stuff to work. right? Then they start building out a lake. And then when they start building out a lake is when they actually check out project security. And then usually you hire a data engineering team. They check out projects like Hoodie, Debezium, Spark. They start building out the equivalent stack here. And we saw that a lot of these, while there's a lot of success stories in the community around engineers who are able to make the transition, data engineers became platform engineers and picked up database concepts too, and got to a point of operating, let's say, 6,000 tables, 7,000 tables for your company. There are success stories like that. There's also a lot of stories where, you know, they didn't make the cut, right? These projects fail because there is so much custom DIY build, like the end-to-end solutions aren't there to get a lake house. And also it takes a long time. And even the success scenario, it takes 6 to 8 months to operationalize the lake. So we essentially wanted to say, hey, we already built Hoodie. Now, can we build a cloud service which gives you this same ease of use, same time to market as the more closed cloud warehousing stack, but it can deliver drastically faster data freshness, cost, efficiency. It's future proof because all of your data is in like an open format Hoodie. And that was the basic idea. So can we provide like a similar experience and similar time to market? And we think this is the new kind of architecture that companies ultimately end up with today. But with something like OneHouse, they would have the opportunity to start with that architecture on day one, instead of like signing up for a migration project 2 years down the line.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I come across that launch blog post and you talk about OneHouse aim to be the bedrock for data infrastructure as the home of all your data. So I'm excited to see some of the pinpoint that you just mentioned in your previous answer got resolved with this new product, right? Enable continuous data delivery, automate data infrastructure, and to help companies unlock saving at scale. Now, you also wrote this dedicated blog post talking about OneHouse commitment towards openness. So can you share about very briefly the plans for OneHouse to continue contributing to the Hoodie community in a meaningful way?
So yeah, absolutely. Right. We want to be champions for Hoodie and not be controlling the project in unpredictable or sort of like undesirable ways. Right. But by and large, that piece pretty much what we try to articulate there, I think openness is something that everybody wants, right? But today, without OneHouse, it comes at a cost of, you need to trade off either more cost for openness, either in terms of more engineers that you need to hire for DIY solutions or like a higher turnaround time for your projects. So we actually want to make it possible for you to be able to, let's say you get started with OneHouse and for some reason you don't want to, like maybe you are in a regulated environment or you just, you're like big enough that you want to build an in-house team anyway. For whatever reason, it should be possible to go back to running just vanilla Hoodie, right? And then of course, there'll be some services that you'll have to build in-house, but by and large, things should work. If you contrast this with some of the other vendors in a similar kind of like lakehouse format kind of space, the approach has been, oh, we'll have a thin format and there's all the marketing, all the pushes around, hey, this is the new format. But if you think about it, the format is a passive thing. It's a means to an end. What people really need is the ingestion service that is pumping data into your query tables. You need the compaction service, the clustering service, and these things are optimizing the storage layout for you to improve query efficiency. So our like commitment is that these things already exist in open source, first of all, everybody. That's how we designed the project, connecting back to all our platform vision that we talked about before. And we want to keep it that way. We believe that as a business, we can add significant value by simply operating all this really well and taking that headache away from you. So our commitment is to make sure this is possible, that you start with OneHouse, you can DIY Hoodie, and then you're DIY Hoodie for a year or two, and then like maybe your team leaves and there's attrition on your team or whatever, and then you should be able to pick up on the managed service again. So that is something that we're building with an eye towards.
Hiring is a critical responsibility of any early stage startup founder. What valuable lesson have you learned to attract the right people who are excited about the mission of OneHouse?
Yeah, great question. I think thankfully, so far, we've been able to attract some really good talent because of Hoodie and the project and the awareness around the project that's been existing for 4 years now. We've been pretty fortunate on that. Maybe I'll talk a little bit about what I learned in terms of what to look for. Engineers and people that you bring on at this stage, in case it's useful to others in the same boat. The one thing that we realized is that the technical skills, deep technical skills that are like super awesome in any role that you hire, but also having people who are fundamentally excited about the vision and want to actually make, let's say, manage lakes a reality, right? Because we are fundamentally trying to bring about a new data architecture, what we believe will be the data architecture that will become the mainstay and what people will start with, right? So you need to also be really excited about that vision, and it needs to make sense to you, right? Not that it's you need to, right? And then we want people who are leaning in and already aligned. Then what you have is a team who's focusing all the energy on thinking about how to make it happen. And that has a lot of compound effects. So we hired also a lot of people. We filtered heavily for culture and this sort of hunger to get this done, right? This vision delivered. That's something that I learned after my first few hires. I quickly realized that this is what.
Yeah, culture matters a lot, and the hunger, passionate for doing the work for a critical venue as a startup. One house also backed by top-tier VC firms such as Greenlock Partners and Addition, some of the firms with stellar track record and deep experience in nurturing enterprise data startup. What fundraising advice could you give to founders who want to seek the right investors for the startups?
Yeah, great question. And again, I think here we were pretty fortunate. It was actually a little bit more painful. I actually had PDF term sheets and stuff before even I had a green card to start a company. So I was really sitting on with VC dating for way too long because we're waiting for it, right? But on the flip side, this meant that I've pretty much spoken to almost a subset of VC firms here. And while what we found was that all of them are great, first of all, they'll always be helpful, but it's also on you to make sure, you know, people matter. You need to make sure you feel like you can work with that person, right? You're going to be, your VC partners are people that you're going to work with. They're going to stick around with you through thick and thin. So the people, the relationships, those things matter a lot as well. It's two-way street, right? The VCs want to understand your vision for what you want to build in this space and understand the prospects of this. But for you as well, we spend a lot of time with different firms trying to understand who would help us more with go-to-market. Who knows this space and the customer profiles in the space really well? Who's connected to that sort of thing, the network and the expertise? And then ultimately, would you want to work with this person for the next 4 or 5 years? At least those are the things that should be top of mind, in my opinion.
So if you're not at this point of conversation, I want to move into the final closing segment, which I'm asking you 3 rapid-fire questions, and you provide quick answers for the listeners. Number one, name 3 people in the distributed database community whose work you admire.
Well, I'll name 4 if you don't mind. For Leslie Lamport, all of the packs was all of the fundamental seminal work on distributed computing. Jeff Bean, all the seminal database implementations that we've been just altering the industry one after another. Daniel Abadi, of course, CStore, and Michael Stonebreaker. I know they're you can talk about one of the others. I think those are good to play names for me.
Absolutely. Number 2, name 1 book that you recommend for engineers to cultivate an entrepreneurial mindset.
Yeah, 0 to 1, I think. Definitely. I would definitely start with that. It's very real. The narration, everything keeps it very real. I did an audiobook, I think. And it's written from a founder's kind of lens, talking through PayPal and all of those stories. And I think really eases the transition for you as an engineer into thinking about the bigger picture things.
Yeah, I feel a startup Bible. And then finally, imagine that you send out a single tweet to all the early stage data infrastructure engineers on Twitter. What could you tweet about?
Yeah, I would just encourage everybody to read all the seminal papers in the space. So this is something that I find myself doing less and less of. We're reading, not that Medium articles aren't great, but I feel like I worry a little bit that we are spending lot like this, just with any other field, even in tech, with social media and like all of these things, there's like way more content for you to digest. And I would encourage the early engineers to ground yourself on like hard facts by people with a lot of gray hair and experience in the field, read books and seminal papers, and build up from there. From there, you can understand most things by differing with the previous thing that you know. But please read these things so that you have very solid foundations to stand on.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, Vinod. I have such a great time chatting with you today, learning everything ranging from initial background in back in India, attempt it just and getting deep into database distributed engineering, your wide-reaching career working at Oracle, LinkedIn, Uber, Confluent, various thread, building incremental processing work, and sourcing the Apache Hudi project, technical leadership lesson, and then your current journey with One House, just continuing on the Hudi roadmap, and then bringing cutting-edge cloud-managed lighthouse service to the enterprise. I'll be sure to include everything that we talk about today in the show notes, so listeners can have a chance to take a look, follow up with you, and learn more about your journey with One House and Hudi as interested. So thanks a lot, Vinod, and I hope you have a fabulous rest of your day.
All right. Thank you so much, and thanks for having me. This was really fun.
Well, that's the wrap for another episode of DataCast. Hopefully, you have learned something insightful and interesting from my guest today. You can read the show notes from the podcast website at datacast.simplecast.fm. If you want to get instant updates when a new episode is released, either follow me on Twitter or subscribe to my newsletter on my website, jamescaley.com. It is my greatest pleasure that you listen to this podcast and take advantage of the data revolution coming upon us. Goodbye for now.